You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the American Hour, and I am Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome to the show. You can find us on the USATalkRadioNetwork.com. Follow us on Twitter at the American Hour, and please go to our Facebook pages, the American Hour Radio Show. Look that up under Facebook, and do me a favor, go click on the like button. The more people we have liking us, the easier it is to get sponsors, and that just adds into it. But anyway, thank you for joining us today on this beautiful day. Of course, depending on where you're at, it could be rainy, but it's beautiful here in southern Florida. And of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon Osman. How are you doing today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. How are you?
And you were just explaining to us what the weather was like up there. You said a balmy 55, but is it clear skies?
Yeah, it's like I said, it feels like fall.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of people probably here in South Florida that wouldn't mind being in the Boston area right now or in New England with that kind of weather because it has been pretty warm and humid. But for those of us that live here and are used to it, I love it. Love it, love it, love it. I could spend all day outside in the, well, maybe not all day outside, but I like going outside and hanging out. And if you're dressed properly and you're acclimated, it's not too bad. All right. Well, we've got a special guest on the show today. He'll be calling in just a few minutes, Dean Black, and I'll let him introduce himself. But I met him on the campaign trail, and he was running for District 3 in Florida, which has an incumbent named Corrine Brown. If you want to find out more about the liberal Corrine Brown, just Google that, and you'll find out why most of us as conservatives were supportive of Dean Black trying to get her out of that gerrymandered and geographically targeted district, and it's not the easiest thing. But we gave it a shot, and maybe Dean will give that a chance another day or help whoever might come along to try and take her out the next time, but not really doing Floridians any favors. Okay, so he'll be on the show. Matt Falconer tomorrow is going to be on the show. If you want to know more about Matt, go take a look at him on Facebook. He's always pasting stuff, and there's some great information, especially about things that apply to Central Florida. And if you go to our website, usatalkradionetwork.com, go to my page, and there are links there to the press releases for both Dean Black today and Matt Falconer tomorrow. And you can see I put a little bit of information about each of them, but it'll be a good show tomorrow. It's going to be a great show today. Dean's a military veteran and a business owner, and he's got some great perspective on some of the issues that are facing us in this country. Now, yesterday we wrapped up the show talking about immigration. And, of course, just a few minutes ago, the president was giving a speech in Texas on immigration. I don't know if he's finished or not. I couldn't stand to listen to much more than about the first 2 minutes of it because, of course, he always tells us things that just aren't true. For example, I was reading an article this morning about how this administration has secured the border more secure than ever before. And they cite that since 2002, the number of border agents has doubled. Wow, doubled? That sounds like we must be really secure now, huh, Paula? Because we got double the agents. Well,
right.
We've got about quadruple the number of illegal immigrants and crime coming across. And how do I know that? Because I have a very good friend who's a police officer in Tucson, Arizona. And he tells me the crime has only gotten worse. So let's see, if the border is more secure simply because we have more agents, but we got more stuff coming across the border, I'd say it's not more secure. Doesn't add up. So they're using one simple little number to prove that. I mean, just think about that, Paul. That's just the most childish explanation. Well, we've got more border agents, so therefore we must be more secure. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. That's sort of like, as a military guy, you know, I was a fighter pilot. So let's say that we're defending a particular spot in, the Western Pacific. In fact, let's call it Pearl Harbor. We're defending Pearl Harbor from a Japanese attack. And we say, look, we've got more ships and sailors and airplanes in port right now than we've had in 10 years. And so, therefore, we must be more secure. Well, but if we're not doing our jobs, and it's not that anybody wasn't doing their job, but nobody expected this to happen and we weren't prepared, how secure is it? Not secure at all. they needed to be out to sea and ready to go. And even then, the numbers may have been overwhelming in any case. So the president continually deceives the American people with suggesting that he's doing a better job. I mean, I really could see this guy walking into a room and saying, wow, what nice blue walls you have on the nice blue paint you have on the walls here. And it's clearly white, and everybody looks at him. Oh, no, it's blue. Believe me, you just don't know, but it's really blue. That's the kind of way he explains things, and he doesn't use any actual reality in his campaigning, which is what he's doing now, campaigning. So here's the next big push, illegal immigration. And we said yesterday, not only is he wrong about how secure the borders are right now, but he is not being truthful about what they're trying to do. He's going around in his campaign speech right now saying, we've got to secure the borders, and we've got to – this came out in an article yesterday saying that the administration has put out to its operatives that we've got to shift the discussion about illegal immigration to economics and security. We're going to secure the border, and this is all about improving things for the middle class. Well, I'm going to debunk that here in about 1 second, but that's what he's going around telling people. So it doesn't add up, and the article that I'm looking for is on my other computer. Here it is. Obama ratifies Bush. No one has done more to revive the reputation of Bush-era anti-terror policies than the Obama administration. In its latest policy reversal, actually, that's not the right one. It's about Bin Laden. All right. So we're going to get to Bin Laden a little later. I got a little ahead of myself there. I apparently have lost the article that talked about maybe I got it right here. Nope. I lost the article on him yesterday talking about the sheriff telling us that the Obama administration has told the agents on the border to not arrest illegal immigrants to keep the numbers down. That's a fact. There's no disputing that. The administration is not disputing it. So we've got, as I said yesterday, a federal agency telling its law enforcement officers to look the other way when they say a federal crime being committed. And that's what illegal immigration is. It's a federal crime. So here's something written by a guy with the same name as me that was in the Washington Times. And I'm just going to lay this out because the president's trying to make a case for how this is going to help Americans by giving illegal immigrants amnesty. Whether they get citizenship or not, that's another story. But amnesty, which means now they're legally here. So this is from part of the article. Illegal immigration impacts Hispanic American communities first and foremost, because foreign nationals from south of the border naturally congregate in already established enclaves. I know this for a fact. I've lived in communities and around communities that this is precisely what occurs. Those communities therefore sustain the brunt of crime, gang infestation, and competition for already scarce jobs, housing, education, and social services. While it may be true that some Hispanic Americans might nurture a solidarity with their more recently arrived ethnic cousins, now here's the key. Is this where their own true futures lie? Of course not. Are there real world interests associated with the illegal arrival of millions of neighbors from their old countries, or is it with their fellow American citizens? With the old world they left behind, or the new society which they are a part of, isn't the ethnic demagoguery associated with the so-called pathway to citizenship in effect a pathway to Balkanization? Exactly. So I continue on. I'll read one more paragraph here. This was the title of this article was The Rovian Fallacy, and so I was kind of going after Karl Rove because he tried involving the Republican Party in trying to steal away amnesty from the Democrats, and if we do that, then, yeah, they're going to remember us, so here I go. Second, Mr. Rove's theory rests on the assumption that newly amnestitized voters will remember that the Republican Party helped pave their pathway to citizenship and reward the party with future support. But let's look at the facts. The overwhelming majority of illegal aliens have less than high school education, and many are not even literate in their own languages. And again, I know that firsthand. I've seen it growing up in Arizona, southern Florida, and now living in southern California, and now southern Florida. When I go to speak with some of these folks that I might see standing on a corner looking for a job, just to say hi and ask them where they're from, because I'm curious, they start speaking to me in Spanish, and it's kind of like, whoa. That's pretty crude Spanish. It'd just be like talking to somebody in English that speaks English but comes from a poor family and just doesn't speak very good. And so I've noticed that myself. I've noticed that over the years. Let's see. They have less than high school education. This doesn't mean they're not good people, But it does mean they are natural recipients of the welfare state. Once they receive citizenship in the United States, will they be more likely to favor the big government, wealth-transferring, multiculturalistic nanny state promised and promoted by the Democrat Party, or the smaller government, self-reliant, lower-taxing, entrepreneurial, assimilative society championed by the Republican Party? Yes, the poor ones, they're going to be looking for handouts. If that's available and the Democrats promise it, they will. I do know that people like you and I that leave one of our Spanish-speaking countries or any country around the world and come to the United States are looking for opportunity, and we talked about that yesterday. And finally, when it does come to the poor immigrants, whether they get citizenship or not, I guarantee you once they're legal, they will unionize. They won't do it on their own. There are plenty of organizations chomping at the bit for all of those new members to join their roles of the private sector union. If you know, if you've been paying attention to the news in the last few years, private sector unionization is dropping, while public sector is going up. So that's a problem in itself. But private sector is going down. And I'm not opposed to private sector unions, but what I'm saying is the entrepreneurs out there within these private sector unions are going to jump all over these new legal immigrants, whether they're just workers or not, and unionize them to tap into their wages and drive their wages up. So this whole concept about this is good for the economy because we've got people that are willing to work for low wages, first of all, I consider that slave labor and inhuman and immoral, the way we treat them to begin with. And that's got to end. So that's all the more reason to say no to illegal immigration. And I'll wrap it up by saying this. There's no difference between an immigrant and an illegal immigrant, except that one's doing it illegally. There's no difference than a shoplifter and a shopper, except one's doing it illegally. I want to know when the liberal left is wanting to stand up and shake their fist and scream out that we need to give amnesty to shoplifters, because we can use all the same arguments for them. We need to bring them out of the shadows. They're just a poor person trying to provide for their family. They came from a poor country and they just don't have much. All the same arguments that we use for illegal immigrants. So does this mean we're going to give amnesty to all the shoplifters out there? And here's the real difference. When you go to Walmart or 7-Eleven and you grab something worth $20 and try and steal and get caught, we prosecute you the full extent of the law. Unless you're a kid, and then they'll take you to your parents and me, you know, let you off this time. But we prosecute you. Why is it that someone who is attempting to steal the most precious treasure that we have in this country, citizenship, we want to just let them go? Oh, yeah, A-okay. Well, here's what happens, and I saw it happen in California. It's continuing to happen in California. The amnesty that Reagan gave in most part, to Hispanics in California, that's where the majority of the demographic was. You can see that later generations don't appreciate citizenship. When you have children and you just give them things all the time, they don't value them. But if they earn them, then they value them. And what we're seeing in California is a couple generations now of people who do not value their citizenship and are militaristic in their heritage and do not want to be called Americans but want to be called Mexicans, and yet they are American citizens. That will be the trend over the rest of the country. If we give wholesale amnesty to illegal immigrants throughout the rest of the country, their children will not value something that our parents and our forefathers earned. And some people say, Tom, when you were born, you didn't earn your citizenship. It was given to you. My grandfather, actually it'd be my great-grandfather, earned the right to pass it on to all of his following generations. It was earned there, and then I re-earn it by the way I conduct myself as an American citizen. That's the way it works. And I'm not willing to give away something that valuable to somebody who has attempted to steal it, whether it's them or even their poor, I'm sorry, unfortunate children. My own kids will pay the price by them flooding into not only the marketplace but the schools and taking over valuable resources that I have worked my whole life to provide for my children and that I've paid taxes for my entire life. No, I say no. I really feel bad for them, but they knew they were breaking the law when they came here. So, all right. I know I got on another tirade about immigration, but it really bothers me when I see the president get up there and just repeat lie after lie after lie about the situation and try and mislead people. And the bottom line is this. Whether we support amnesty or not, it's really not going to change, for the most part, the voting process. And I can tell you this right now. From my own experience at looking at the numbers in Florida, Hispanics have a very low turnout rate, The only way to get them out is going to be significant legwork. And one of the things that is going to help, and we did it, thank goodness, in Florida, we got Marco Rubio elected. When he goes and talks and speaks in Hispanic communities, they will listen to him. He's a senator in the United States Senate. Marco Rubio, Hispanic communities will listen to him. And when I say Hispanic communities, I'm talking about American communities of Hispanic heritage that can actually vote. And they will listen to him, and they like what he has to say because he came from a family that, or is in a family, that originally came from Cuba, and he's got an interesting story, if you've ever heard his story, about how his parents came to this country and why they came to this country. And that's really what most immigrants are looking for. So the Democrat Party has it all wrong when it comes to, well, if we can get them in this country and legalize them, then they're just going to be like the rest of the poor people in the country that when we throw our little scraps of handouts, then they're going to always vote for us. They're wrong because they don't understand the Hispanic culture, and that's not how it's going to work. But in any case, a lot of work for us to do as we get into this election season, and hopefully we can rally the leaders within some of these communities to speak up and talk about why we're a republic and not a democracy. All right. So with that said, let's bring Dean Black on and talk the rest of the hour with Dean Black. How are you doing today, Dean?
I am great, Commander. Paula, Tom, thank you so much for having me on the show on the USA Radio Network. I was listening to your, should we call that a tirade, Tom?
Yeah.
I think that qualifies as a tirade. I'm with you. I am with you. I think the very next thing that we're going to hear out of this regime is amnesty. I think this is all about setting the stage for amnesty.
Yeah.
And you know, you made really every point there is to make on that subject, but I would just add, you know, one of the reasons why people want to come to this country is because it's a great country, the greatest country in the history of mankind, and what made it great was respect for the law,
yeah,
which guarantees equal opportunity for all. But if we continue to allow people to come here and flout the law by that very action, we ultimately are destroying the very thing that made the nation worthwhile in the first place.
Yep.
And that's why when I was campaigning, when I was running for Congress in the 3rd District, I campaigned in the Hispanic community. I speak Spanish. I have many friends who are Hispanic, and they would tell me on this topic, no, they did not want amnesty. They wanted the people to come here legally the same way they did, because that's fair, and that's what made America great.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote that op-ed for the Washington Times, because the same thing, I've grown up in Hispanic communities. My name is Garcia, and my background is from Mexico. And when I was campaigning, I was talking to some different groups. I went to some really great groups like the Panamanian Club in Orlando area and a lot of other groups where when I spoke with the folks about their concerns, immigration and amnesty was not near the top of their list at all, not even anywhere close. And the number one issue I found was housing, 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 housing. So in my article, that's why I talked about the natural enclave for folks coming across illegally is to find some of these neighborhoods where they're tending to find people that are grouping together from their background and kind of try and blend in. And all it does is run down those neighborhoods because they're going to be day laborers or whatever it is that they're doing because they're here illegally. And even if they get a decent job, and I know some illegal immigrants that found some decent jobs, but they got to be real careful. But it just draws the community down, and that's not what their concern was. It was housing. And I'm not going to go into details of why, but housing is a problem in Central Florida for the Hispanic community. And there's some reasons for that, and I'll talk about that on another show. But there were some other concerns that they had. Amnesty was not one. And just like you said, Dean, they tell me the same thing. I'm not for amnesty. I had to earn my citizenship, or my father, or my mother, or whoever had to earn their. Now, let me ask you about this. What do you think about the DREAM Act and this whole concept of, but we've got, you know, probably several million kids that were brought here. They're just kids. They had no choice. And now that they've grown and ready to become adults, they're going to be penalized because of what their parents did.
When we start bringing kids into the mix, that's always a tough question. And I think we always need to go back to the Constitution and look at what the Constitution says. And where there's legislative authority, we then go back and look at what the law says.
Yeah.
The fact is, the 14th Amendment, the way it's been interpreted by the courts, grants that citizenship.
Yeah.
Now, we may disagree with that. People from both parties may agree or disagree with it, but We live in a republic where we have to respect, whether we agree with it or not, the decisions of the higher courts. And so far, that's their opinion. And honestly, we've got some really big fish to fry. You know, yeah. Our border is, we have completely lost control of our border. You know, earlier on in this conversation, Tom, you were talking about how Obama was saying, well, he's doubled the number of border agents. But you and I both know as military people, that is meaningless if you're completely overwhelmed still. And that's
yes.
exactly what's happening there.
Yep.
And you also talked about how you made the comparison between, you were talking about legal and illegal immigration and shopping versus shoplifting. I couldn't agree with you more, my friend. Illegal immigration has to stop. Until it does, our border is not secure. We're not exercising national sovereignty over our own nation, and it's not safe, particularly with the level of violence that's taking place on the border and spilling over our border.
Yeah.
And we should keep in mind the court case is working its way through the court system now with Arizona, Governor Brewer, and they're trying to exercise the sovereignty that the federal government patently refuses to do. You know, I never thought I'd live to see the day where this nation would not protect its borders, would leave its people vulnerable to what is really can only be classified as some form of an invasion.
Yep.
And
well, I said that yesterday. I quoted the Constitution yesterday in Section 4, Article 4. Or Article 4, Section 4, that says the federal government guarantees to each and every state protection from invasion. And so they've failed on that part. They have not lived up to a constitutional requirement. And then they've told their agents, look the other way. Look the other way when a crime's being committed. That is heinous. I think that's, you know, that's criminal in itself. But, you know, you're right about the court's ruling on the 14th Amendment that, well, it means anybody that's born here is born here. What happens when a tourist is here? If a tourist is here on a visa, and their kid is born, can they go to the government and say, hey, listen, my kid was born here, I want a U.S. birth certificate. And then as soon as they get that, they can go back to France and say, now you're a dual citizen, and we'll get you a birth certificate here, because in France, you were born to us, it doesn't matter where, and you get a birth certificate here. I mean, is that, there's all kinds of games and shenanigans get played, and you and I know the intent. And in fact, you don't have to be a lawyer to read the 14th Amendment and go, well, that's not what it means at all. That you can just be born here. It doesn't mean that at all. But what about these kids that are brought here? They were born in Mexico or born in another country, born in Russia, born in wherever, Poland. And they were brought here after being born abroad, and now they're here. And, you know, they've been, quote, in the shadows. And now, as they become young adults, now what? What do we do for them? And the DREAM Act wanted to give them amnesty. What do you think of that?
I think what you do for one, you'd have to do for another. And Tom?
Yeah. Well, here's my take on it. Number one, if you kick some parents out of the country, they always make it sound like, oh, their parents are illegal immigrants and you're making them go back to such and such a country. What are the poor kids going to do? How about go with their parents? If I got kicked out of a country and my kids were young, they'd come with me. I wouldn't leave them behind. What kind of parenting is that? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I was just about to say, Tom, you know, people say, well, this is a terrible thing, and, you know, that's an awful thing for the government to do to the kids, except that it's really not the government doing anything. It's the parents that did this by the decisions that they made.
Yeah.
And I, you know, although we can sit here and, you know, we sort of make our living pointing out the faults and things that we think need to be fixed, and gosh knows there is a litany of such things we can point out. Tom, I'm very optimistic for the future. I think 2012 is going to be it, my friend.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I know. You're always an optimistic guy, and I like that about you, and I think you're absolutely right. We've got a bright future ahead of us. We've got to just capitalize on what the left has done to this country so far, number one, and then we need to find some people to fill in the cracks where we weren't able to do that, say, in 2012, like in, say, for example, the 3rd District of Florida, and then we've got to get rid of this president. We've got to make him a one-termer.
My great-grandmother used to say, it's really hard to win an argument when you're wrong. And in politics, when we have these debates, that's really all we're having is an argument, and that's why I'm so optimistic for the future, Tom. We're right. the decisions that the left has have made, not just over the past few years, but the past few decades, are proven empirically to have been a disaster. And I think we're going to take America back. I think, you know, everyone wanted to do it all in 2010, and that was not realistic. It took a long time to create this damage. It'll take a long time to fix it. But I think we will. And I think the bin Laden killing gives Obama a blip of popularity, as these things tend to do. But that will fade away, and he will be left with the reality of his overall job performance, which is terrible.
Yeah.
And I think we will remove him, provided that we nominate the correct candidate. I think that he'll be gone. I think we can take the Senate back. And I think we can get this government back to its constitutional roots. And I think we can restore the greatness that is America. I don't believe our best days are behind us, Tom.
Yeah.
I hear everyone lamenting the national debt. And I do, too, because that can destroy my future. That can destroy my kids' future, my grandchildren's future. We project to have a debt of 120% of GDP within the next few years, and that's atrocious, but it is not unprecedented.
Yeah.
The greatest generation, my grandmother, grew up in a time after World War II where, you know, they had faced an enemy worldwide that wanted to kill us all. They had the Great Depression, and they were faced with debt that was greater than 120% of GDP after World War II. But, Tom, they paid the debt. They won the war. They restored the economy, and they made the greatest nation in the history of the earth. If they did it, we can do it too. And the worst thing that we as conservatives and we as Republicans can do is to sit back and wring our hands and whine and cry. It's time, like our governor in the state of Florida likes to say, it's time to get to work. You know, if this is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, then it is necessarily we the people who let this happen. That means we have a job to do. We as patriots, we as Americans, and we above all else as parents, we have a duty to not let the future be stolen from our children. And we can do that. Sorry, I didn't mean now I'm on a tirade, Tom.
Yeah, that's okay. No, you covered a lot of good things there, and I absolutely agree. Well, now you brought up bin Laden, and this is going to ultimately, I think, be a thorn in Obama's side, because as more information comes out, we see what a lousy leader he is and how much he vacillated and really didn't want to engage in this. I can't think of anybody that I know like you or myself or you know somebody that's been a leader in the military, and even some of our leaders in government right now, that the instant they're told we know exactly where bin Laden is, get him now, done. You know, there wouldn't have been any waste of time. Yeah, we would have said, okay, explain the logistics, blah, 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 but, you know, that would have happened immediately. There wouldn't have been.
Well, they've been calling him the dither-in-chief for a reason, and that seems to have be a common trait when it comes to foreign affairs. You know, I'm just glad we got him. I think ultimately the right way to get him was chosen. I think he could have done so more decisively.
Yeah.
But let's do give credit where credit is due, because in 2012, when all of America is asked to make the decision as to who is to lead us for the next 4 years, let us not be in a position where they can point the finger at us and say, we don't give credit where credit is due. We will win that election based on the merits of the arguments. And I don't think we have anything to fear about winning that election as long as we do what we're supposed to do. He made the decision belatedly. He dithered. It's fair to question him for that.
Yeah.
But let's give credit where credit is due. And above all else, let's give the SEALs credit where credit is due. I am sick to death of hearing from the UN Human Rights Commission questioning our killing of bin Laden because he was unarmed. I don't know who they think they are. We're a sovereign nation, and they're in no position to question such a decision. That is a decision made to attack a command and control target in wartime, and it's a decision made by the troops on the ground based on self-defense. And it is solely up to them to decide whether their target is complying with their demands. Now, you know, bin Laden's a pretty dangerous guy. He has a tendency to really support suicide bombings, and they're certainly within their right to assume that this guy may blow up the building and everybody in it. So,
yeah.
this was going to be a really hard guy to take alive. The only way that might have happened would have been, you know, had he fallen to his knees and begged for mercy instantaneously and with no hesitation at all. But it is not for us to second question the decision made by the guys on the ground. And people, especially on the left, have been questioning that. They've been questioning of the president, and I would argue once again that really wasn't his call. That
yeah.
was the, you know, the boots on the ground that made that call, and even some within our own party. And let's give credit where credit is due, and let's not second guess our men and women in uniform. You and I have both served. You and I both know what it's like to wake up every day and know what the next set of orders you're going to get might say. Let's not question those guys. They made the right
yeah.
call. And I think we should be thankful, and I think we should continue on the war on terror and win the thing. And I think that it can be won.
Absolutely. Well, I will give credit where credit is due. Thank you, George Bush.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
had it not been for waterboarding, had it not been for them getting tough with some of the senior leaders of Al-Qaeda, and let's remember, these guys who are interrogators, I mean, these are not kindergarten teachers here. These are military intelligence people in wartime. They have a tough job to do, and it's not always pretty.
Yeah.
But what they did was necessary to get cooperation. They didn't gouge anybody's eyes out. Nobody
right.
suffered any permanent physical harm. And but for that, we'd not have had this opportunity to take out bin Laden.
Exactly.
And it absolutely vindicates President Bush, and I might add it vindicates the general counsels of all four members of the military branches who reviewed this policy and determined that they were lawful orders. You and I as military men, we were always taught you don't carry out an unlawful order, right, Tom?
Right, yeah.
So
exactly.
when people were saying that, you know, these things were happening and they were wrong and unlawful, weren't they really criticizing either our military men and women in uniform, in the case of military intelligence and analysts, or the civilian equivalents in the CIA, DIA, and so on? Weren't they questioning their integrity? How dare they? They're not qualified to shine their boots.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely agree.
And I'm optimistic about the war on terror. I think we have been fighting a war against theocracy. And that the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, we have been supporting democratic change there for some years now, and it was always understood that we needed to provide a counterpoint in that area of the world so that we could have something for the people there to contrast bin Laden's view of the world. He wanted to create a Muslim caliphate. Something like the Taliban had in Afghanistan. Who can imagine a life more horrific than that? But
yeah.
we wanted to give Republican democracy as a choice and compare it against that. This is an ideological war, not altogether different from the Cold War, really. And ideological wars, military history teaches us, tend to last a very long time, 30 to 60 years on average. It was never meant to be a quick war. Bush made that very clear in the very earliest days. It's a long war, but we're winning it, and we should not be surprised that a wave of democratic revolution should be sweeping the Arab world. This is what we wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, now
Al-Qaeda should absolutely regard it as a mortal threat. As
yeah.
an absolute mortal threat. It will be full. We shouldn't kid ourselves. It will be difficult. It is fraught with danger, too. But it is a sign that the grand strategy of this ideological war is working.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, you are absolutely right, my friend. And I didn't do that when we first brought you on. But tell people your background. Now, you've mentioned you were military. Tell people what you did in the military. And I seem to remember part of the reason you speak Spanish is because you spent some time in Panama. Wasn't that it?
Yes. I was in the Air Force and the 125th Fighter Wing, Florida Air National Guard. If anybody out there is listening, hoorah. I was in security forces, and I also served as a linguist and served as a liaison between U.S. and Panamanian forces very shortly after the war to remove Manuel Noriega. And I was in radio for many, many years. I ran a morning show in the Memphis ADI. I've been a conservative talk radio show host at WOKV in Jacksonville, radio stations in Gainesville, North Mississippi, a number of other. I've been in radio off and on for many years, been a journalist, a news director. Today I own, operate, and buy and sell and develop Amco Transmissions franchises, dabble in some real estate. I have a farm, and most recently ran for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District, and by the will of the people was not chosen to be the nominee. And unfortunately, the gentleman who was chosen did not succeed in defeating her. I surely wish he had.
Yeah, we all did. But, yeah, that was one of those tough races. It's just a gerrymandered district that's going to be tough for the right person to get in there since she's been in there. It's sort of like Alcee Hastings down here to the south. It's hard to get rid of that guy. You know, one of the only federal judge to be impeached in modern history, and he's proud of it. He's proud of it. That's the sick thing about it.
Unbelievable. Yeah, they found $90,000 cash in his freezer.
Yeah. Well, that was a guy in Louisiana, I think. Alcee Hastings, no. He's a congressman. He's not gotten in trouble as a congressman, but he frequently, when he stumps in his district, uses lots of racial epithets, and he has threatened his last two congressional opponents, threatened them on stage in front of people, and he's a hoodlum is what he is, but it's hard to get rid of him because, you know, every Thanksgiving he goes around and passes out some free turkeys, and Christmas, you know, and passes out free ham, and that's about it. And he hired his girlfriend to be his chief of staff, and, you know, pays her handily and provides her with a vehicle and all this other stuff. Somebody asked him once about his Cadillac, and, you know, said, is that taxpayer expense, your Cadillac that you drive around? He goes, yeah, of course it is. He's not bashful about that kind of stuff. So, anyway.
Well, we shall have some new districts drawn here in Florida, and I am hopeful that those will go to good conservative candidates and that we'll expand our majorities, not just in Florida, but all across the country. And let's take the Senate and let's get the job done.
Yeah. Now, how can people connect with you if they want to? I don't know if I mentioned earlier. I'm going to mention it again. I apologize. But you may be starting up a radio show. You may be writing for the newspaper. You haven't quite decided which direction you want to go. But how can people keep track of what you're up to so that if you do start broadcasting here in the future or even writing articles, that they can find that stuff? Well, how would you like them to connect with you?
Now, the best way to contact me is through Facebook. Just search Dean Black. And I'll be very easy to find. We have a website that'll be coming up called defendingthedream.us. It's not online yet, but be looking for that as well, and that'll get announced through Facebook. And articles and a radio show are all in the offing. Right now I'm focusing on helping some good conservative candidates in Northeast Florida. We have our local election, so we're trying to take care of political business there. And,
yeah.
And I live to fight another day, as you do too. It's a long war. Sometimes the best thing you can do for your team, though, is sit on the bench and wait your turn.
Yeah.
And Dean Black standing by.
Good way of putting it. Well, whatever you decide to do, I'll be paying attention. You can always shoot me an email, and we'll get it on the website to let people know and help you promote whatever you're going to be doing next. But we're glad you're on our team, Dean, and appreciate your service to your country and everything that you continue to do as a good, true American patriot.
Likewise yours.
Well, thank you so much. Let's get Paula in on this. Paula, was there anything you saw today in the news that really stood out to you?
Yes, I did come across something that the Senate delays action on the siting of wind farms out in Madison, Wisconsin.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I don't know if you heard anything about that. Republican Senate held off action today on a bill that would have sent new rules on siting wind farms back to the State Public Service Commission for more work. The Senate voted 19-14 along party lines to send the bill back to committee rather than take it up and have possibly voted down. The governor, Scott Walker, and Republicans in the legislature say that the rule that the PSC adopted last year would allow wind turbines to be built too close to nearby properties, while wind energy advocates said the rule is the product of compromise between wind developers and groups seeking to block wind farms. The rule included specific noise and shadow flicker standards, which comes up very often, you know, when siting for the turbines, the farms, to protect nearby property owners and any possible effect from the turbines. Several wind energy companies have stopped development work in that state because of the state of flux in Wisconsin's wind energy policy. Senate Minority Leader Mark Miller, a Democrat from Monona, said the bill should have been taken up Tuesday and rejected to allow the original PSC rules to move forward and signal the state embraces investment in wind energy. The bill, which would still have to be passed by both the Senate and the Assembly, would give the PSC 6 months to develop a new statewide standard. The wind is free, but the windmills are not, is what Senator Frank Lacey, a Republican from DePere, who is a supporter of that bill, said that wind farms raise energy costs and harm the value of nearby homes and properties. A constant battle between people that want the turbines and that don't want the turbines is what's occurred and what continues.
Can you believe what a wind farm Congress is on this? My heavens.
I know.
I wonder with that degree of regulation if they'll ever get anything done at all. Oh, you know, speaking of wind farms and endless sources of hot air, when I was speaking just a moment ago, I forgot to mention the most important thing, Tom. My wife, Kimberly, and I have 5 wonderful children, and I spend a lot of time doing that as well.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Yeah. Well, you do have a very nice, lovely family, and that's wonderful. That is that, you know, we're bringing kids into this world that have good role models and a composite family and everything else. So that's fantastic. You know, I don't know who wants the wind farms. I'm all for wind farms, but I know if you put them too close to a city or a metropolitan area, anything like that, they're actually very noisy. Now, I think they're working on some models now that are quieter, but it's just the nature of the business. And now if you're talking farmers, you know, it all is also a case of, okay, who's out there? You got to be careful where you place them. But there's a typical Democrat state legislator saying, we should just, you know, say no and move on and too bad. You know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. It doesn't matter if people are complaining and saying that, and in the way he put it, you know, complaining and saying about the noise, maybe we need to reevaluate what's allowable and what's not allowable. And he says, because we're pro-creating jobs. This is precisely what's happened in Florida with SunRail and high-speed rail. We've got legislators, even Republicans, who really don't care what the people want. It's all about creating jobs today. It doesn't matter about raising taxes tomorrow and hurting families in the future. It's all about the temporary government jobs we can create today. And so we've had to fight that ourselves. So there are lots of good ideas out there, but some of these state legislators, we've talked about this earlier, Paula, just muck everything up.
Here's another good idea, Tom.
Yeah.
Here's another good idea, Tom. Let's put one of those wind farms outside Barney Frank's office. You think it'll work?
Yeah, or outside his home. Yeah.
I think that would make a big difference in our energy supply. I really do. And then he would actually be doing something productive.
Right. He could go out there and give his press releases every day and get that generator spinning about, you know, between his spittle and hot air, get that thing going about a bajillion miles an hour. He could probably power all of Boston, Paula.
Oh, Lord.
I know. That's just so mean, isn't it? Well, yeah.
Well,
anyway.
You know what? You speak your mind.
Well, I tell you what, since we're talking a little bit about energy here, I want to throw this out, and we'll get something on the website. I forgot about this last week. I got something from Jackie Schutz from Core Message, and it's about energy. Here's what's going on. There's a construction of a Keystone XL pipeline, which will connect vast amounts of Canadian crude oil to American refineries, could reduce our reliance on oil from Venezuela and the Middle East by 40%. Rather than depending on unstable nations for our energy resources, the pipeline will allow us to work with friendly neighbors in North America. Unfortunately, the project's plan has been researched for almost 3 years. Delays blocking its development continue to be introduced. For this project to become a reality, the State Department is now requiring public comments on the project by June 6th. So here's what they're doing. They're doing these 30-minute webinars, and this is probably something you might want to, if you can fit it in, Paula. It's running, we missed the one today, but there's one Wednesday, Thursday, the next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and I've got the links here. I can't give you a website to go to because it's under gotomeeting.com, and then there's a lengthy number that goes with it. So I'll put them on the website, the links on the website. Anybody out there that's interested in going to these webinars, it's from 2 to 2:30 p.m. It doesn't say whether that's central. I'm going to guess it's Eastern because she's just over here in Tallahassee, Florida. But could be interesting, give you some good information about what's going on, and then allow people to let their friends and neighbors know, okay, here, we need to comment on this so that the State Department, if you can believe that, why the State Department is involved in this, can make a ruling on whether we can have a pipeline from Canada. We already get more of our oil from Canada than anybody else. The most foreign oil that we get from anybody comes from Canada, and this is going to give us even more of it. They got plenty of it, and we can, even if it didn't change the price, I'd love to cut off Venezuela and cut off Iran and some of these other, and the Saudis just say, sorry, don't need your stuff anymore. You know, they'll find somebody for it, but I don't want to be buying it. So,
well, Tom, you know, it just goes to show, you know, they've been working on this for 3 years, and they're going to committee and debate it to death. It takes so long to get something done in this country. And not to change the subject, but if you really want a good example of that, I mean, can we talk tax code for just a moment, Tom?
Yeah,
I know it's your
please.
Show.
Go ahead, please.
The tax code is variously, depending on whose figures you want to believe, roughly 17,000 pages. Now, all the tax code is supposed to do is decide who owes money, how much, and give them an address to send it to. It really shouldn't take 17,000 pages, should it?
No, not at all.
But it is absolutely red-taped to death along with everything else, and that's what we as conservatives, we have got to streamline government. We have got to weed this stuff out. It absolutely gums up the works and the gears of government, And since we're on the topic of the tax code, you know what most of those 17,000 pages are? Loopholes for favored special interests that contribute to the political campaigns for favored congressmen who then owe favors, right, to the businesses that got those interests. So, you know, Aristotle defined a corrupt government, a corrupt legislature, as a legislature legislating for its own benefit. Now, let me ask a question. If we've got Congress getting laws passed to favor special interests so that they will contribute to their campaign so they can keep their job, so they can further their career, isn't that a legislature legislating for its own interest?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so if that's true, this may be strong, but if that's true, then doesn't that mean our Congress as a body is corrupt?
Yeah, I consider them
that's
that anyway.
That's the definition,
but
right?
That's a good example of how they're corrupt, absolutely. And we see that
at
the state level as well.
It absolutely is. Yeah. It absolutely is.
I have
much work to do.
Yeah, I'm going to bring this up because one of the pushes, you know, for smaller government is, it saves us money and the government just doesn't do things well. Did you know that the Secretary of the Treasury for Thomas Jefferson, Secretary Gallatin, when he was talking about reducing the size of the treasury, the expenditures of the government, keeping the government size low, he said, it's not because I want to keep our debt low. It's not because I want to keep our debt low, and I could get the quote, but I'm going to paraphrase here, and I'll give the quote precisely tomorrow. It's not because I want to keep the size of government small for the sake of the treasury. It's because I want to avoid corruption. In other words, the bigger the government gets, the more money we're spending, the easier it is for corruption to find a toehold in the government. And so that was his biggest concern. It wasn't the debt. It wasn't a deficit spending. It wasn't, well, we have the money, but we could just bring in more tax revenue.
Absolutely right.
And that's what his concern was.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
He was absolutely right. As government revenues continued to increase, we saw commensurate with that the rise of careerism in Congress. You know, I was reading a book by George Will, written back in the early 90s called, The Restoration was the name of it. And in it, George Will talks about how he used to oppose term limits, but how as a conservative he came full circle to actually supporting term limits. And one of the things that he talks about in there is how right around the turn of the century, the average number of congressmen who were running for more than one consecutive term was four. Four. Whereas now, of course, it's 280 or so. And by the way, along that time was when gerrymandering came to be popular. Prior to that, people had tried it, but the people would never stand for it because it was so obviously corrupt. But they began gerrymandering, and the rise of careerism continued to increase, and they began using special favors to cultivate special interests who would contribute to their campaigns, and incumbency became the norm. Prior to that, that wasn't the norm. People didn't go to Congress hardly ever to make a career. They'd go, serve a few terms, come back to their community, and often they'd go back to their state legislatures or back to their farm or what have you. I really believe that the institution as a whole, although there are some good people there, I think the institution as a whole needs dramatic reform, and I support, as you know from back during the campaign, I support term limits wholeheartedly.
Yeah, oh, I do too. And it's not even so much, people always say, well, hey, if we want to get rid of our congressman, we can just, you know, vote somebody else in. It's not about me getting rid of my congressman because we just did that in my district. It's about me getting rid of yours. You know, it's the way I get rid of Nancy Pelosi. She has no say in it. You know, after X number of terms, she's gone. And Barney Frank, these career politicians, we need something in place to stop them. So I absolutely agree. Yeah, you got that one exactly right. And then, poor Paula there in Massachusetts. I know there are probably quite a few, both at the state level as well as federal level, that you'd like to see gone.
I'm sure. Well, you know, when we talk about amending the Constitution, everyone thinks it's really hard, and it is, and that's why it's only been done a few times. But after great climactic, traumatic periods in our country's history, that's when we're able to do that. And yes. After such times, the average length of time then it takes to present a constitutional amendment and have it actually ratified and become law has been 18 months.
Yeah, I was going to say typically around a couple years. Yeah, exactly.
It can absolutely be done. It can absolutely be done. And and I think it's time we do it. And I also support, by the way, a balanced budget veto amendment, which is a permutation of that was put out by the Heritage Foundation. But if we did that and we greatly simplified our tax code and implemented term limits, we could restore this nation to good governance, and we the people would be in charge again, and we would salvage our children's future and restore the greatness that is America. I don't believe our best days are behind us.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, here's a perfect example of the sort of corruption. I mean, it's not illegal corruption, but the cronyism that's going on. We're going to get two new districts in Florida. I guarantee you the new congressional district that we get in Central Florida and the one we get in South Florida, all you have to do when the Florida legislature comes out with here's what the new districts look like, look at the two new districts and see which senior legislator lives in that district, and that's why that district was made, and that senior legislator will then be running for Congress in that district in the next session. I guarantee it. That's exactly how it works. Every time you get a new district, they work together to decide, in general, where we want it to go. We want it to go here, and this person's about to be term limited out or been here for 6 years in the legislature. Yep, let's draw a district for them that they can win, and we've seen it happen.
Well,
the
Fair Districts Amendment at the state level, I'm hoping will help improve our governance at the state level. Now, on the federal side, you know, Corrine Brown and Diaz-Balart, I think, have sued to have that overturned. For those that aren't aware, in Florida, we voted to amend the state constitution to do away with gerrymandering for both state legislative seats and for U.S. congressional seats. Corrine Brown and Diaz-Balart both sued and argued. And, Tom, you know I'm no friend to Corrine Brown, right?
Yeah, I know that.
But But darn it all, I've read some of her briefs, and I hate to admit it, but I think she's right on this one. I think she's right. Her argument is that the U.S. Constitution grants to the legislatures of the several states the right to set the times, places, and therefore the boundaries for congressional elections, and that an amendment to a state constitution can't change that, but only an amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
I would agree with that.
That's a pretty powerful argument.
Yeah,
I think
I'm
going
to have to look at
that
and see. Well, but here's the counter-argument. I'm not making it, but this is going to be the counter-argument, and that is, but it's the state legislature that is choosing the bipartisan or nonpartisan or whatever committee that's going to do it. So by proxy, it is the legislature that's doing it with a nonpartisan committee that's chosen by the legislature. That's what they're going to argue. So, hey, if you want to go by semantics and stretching
things. That's
what
they'll argue, and the law on it is –
yeah.
You know, the case law on it does say you must give great weight to that. So it's not a foregone conclusion, but I would think that, you know, if you were going to poll law professors and so on, I think probably 90% of them would agree with Corrine Brown's point and maybe 10% otherwise. I'm rooting for the 10%, mind you. I don't think we should give up. But,
yeah. Well, and it always brings in the question, if it's a bipartisan, you know, or nonpartisan committee or council that's selected, who gets to select them and who is it that gets selected? You know, if you're somebody in the state legislature who picks somebody beyond that council who just retired or just term limited out and was very conservative, you know what their viewpoints are and you know what they're probably going to do, and you can always have lunch with them and discuss things. I mean, the cronyism can continue. I don't know how to end that other than what you talked about, and that is really with term limits, and it has occurred in the state of Florida. I think term limits have been beneficial, and I know for a fact in the federal government they will be beneficial. As we continue to get fresh blood in repeatedly because of term limits, you're going to start to see this lifelong cronyism go away. And it will never be completely gone, but I believe it will get better.
I agree, Tom. I agree. And one of the things that, you know, here in Florida, we did implement term limits for our state legislatures, and that has been a trend, a growing trend all across the country, but many states are still struggling to get that done. One of the arguments that George Will made back in the early 1990s was that if we want to see term limits at the federal level, then we need to first begin pushing them at the state level. And since that time, much progress has been made. He said what would ultimately happen is that state legislatures would term limit out. Your state legislative people would term limit out, and there'd be nowhere else to go.
Uh-huh.
And so there would, and because more and more and more of them would accumulate, it would be sort of like water stacking up behind a dam. The people would begin agitating for term limits in Congress because they would want to run for those seats. They would want to free up the logjam, so to speak.
Yeah.
And many, many states since that time, gosh, I want to say maybe 15 or 20. I don't have the notes in front of me at the moment, but we have had a tremendous number of states implement term limits for their state legislatures, and many more still trying to do it. And, you know, I think this is something that we can get done at the state level and at the federal level. I think it can absolutely happen.
Yeah, well, good. Well, listen, we're out of time. And as you said earlier, before the show, an hour goes by fast. One of these days when we're able to, we'll start broadcasting for more than that. And we look forward to that. But for right now, boy, time does fly. It's been great having you on the show, Dean. I really appreciate your friendship and your contribution to the state of Florida as well as our government and the things that you continue to do. So great having you on the show. We will have you back, and please make sure you let me know if you do get one of your projects going here. We will put it out over the show, put it on the website, Facebook, and everything else so we let a lot of people know what you're up to. And
Paula,
keep up.
Paula,
with
Commander, thank you very much for having me on the USA Radio Network. Have a great day.
Thanks, Dean. Take care. Say hello to the family.
Do it.
All right, Paula. Well, we're pretty much in the show. And as I said, I'm meeting my wife for dinner. Don't have too much time, but you did send me some stuff that I think is pretty funny. And then I'll give you the last word today. These are from some of the late night shows, and I had one up from like yesterday, but I like this one. President Obama said that watching the raid on Osama bin Laden was the longest 40 minutes of his life. Mind you, that's coming from a guy that has to listen to Joe Biden. Oh, man. And I think that was on the Jay Leno show. Then I saw on the Late Show with Craig Ferguson, President Obama admitted he was nervous while watching the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound, and didn't help that every 2 seconds Joe Biden kept saying, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" Joe Biden, man. What a piece of work he is. Yeah, anyway. All right, I'm going to give you the last word today, Paula. What would you like to tell the people? And tell them what we chatted about with your weekly project on a salute to the troops, and then whatever else you may be working on as either a daily or weekly project.
Well, I guess you're going to have me do a salute to our soldiers, and I've been reaching out to a couple of individuals in my Facebook group. One just left today. He's going back, and I'm going to wait to hear from him. And what we're going to do is we're going to come up with people on a weekly basis to tell their story, and you know, whether it's done through email or whether they can actually call in, I'm unsure of it, if it can be Skyped. You know, the details will be worked on as we go along with this.
Okay.
And big hoorah to Navy serving overseas. We love you and miss you, and your families can't wait to have you back.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. Well, that'll be fun. So let's see. We'll be back tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Again, we got Matt Falconer, and he's going to tell us about the Tea Party's budget proposal that they've been working on. I don't know if he's got it finished yet or not. He also has got an analysis of the existing budget proposals from any of the Democrats, the president, and the Republicans that he'll pick apart for us. And, of course, he's deeply embroiled in Orlando, Central Florida politics. There's some interesting stuff going on there that we're going to talk to him about. So we look for that. So Matt Falconer tomorrow and 4 o'clock Eastern. All right, Paula, have a great evening with your family. Have a nice dinner, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you. You as well, Tom.
Good night.
Good night.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.